Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So it will be on immortality and immateriality. Today's talk, it's important to think about and distinguish between the two. If you take philosophy courses now, often you'll come up against the problem of consciousness, right? The problem of consciousness is something like scientific facts are, you know, third person, objective, whereas consciousness is subjective and first person. And how on earth could you explain consciousness in terms of science, or at least contemporary science? So that's a problem in the philosophy of mind, a contemporary problem. Thomas Aquinas and people before him didn't quite deal with the problem that way. I think they dealt with it in a more interesting way. They talked about different kinds of immateriality. And consciousness to them was interesting, but it wasn't necessarily connected to anything immaterial. All right. And so what you have with Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle and many others before him, he's part of a long tradition, is this concern with different levels, right? Kind of the levels of inanimate things or plants, which don't know anything at all, different levels of animals with different kinds of sense knowledge, and then human beings and what's distinctive about humans and human knowledge. It's not immaterial the way an angel's knowledge would be, angels not having bodies, but it's also not quite the same as a dog's knowledge or a horse's. And so that's what we're going to think about today. People are interested in the immortality of the soul. They're interested in materiality. But I just wanted to give a general structure, a framework in which to think about it.
Right.
So first, I'll just make some remarks about what we mean about immortality and immateriality. And then we'll go through the different levels of sense knowledge and intellectual knowledge. And then last, we'll look at some kind of arguments or suggestive arguments for the incorruptibility or immortality of the human soul in Thomas Aquinas. If you look at your handout, you'll see it's divided in three. There are texts from Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas. First section is sense knowledge for section one. The other text about intellectual knowledge for section two. And then immortality for section three. First, when we talk about the souls being immortal, what do we mean? Right? Of course, we don't mean bodily immortality. All humans die. Right? Another thing, we don't mean incapable of being annihilated by God, the way gods are immortal. Sometimes people like to reserve immortal for something like a god that cannot be destroyed. That's not what we would mean if we're talking about the immortality of the soul. What we mean is just that the soul by itself is not capable of being corrupted or generated even the way that other natural beings are, right? Like everything, a dog or a cat, you can run over it with a car, it's no longer there, it's gone. The idea is you run over a human being, well, part of the human being's gone, but the soul still is there somehow in a strange way. That's what we mean by immortality. It doesn't mean that God can't blot us out of existence if he wanted to. He doesn't, we know through faith, but you know, it's logically possible. It's not beyond his power. Second, immateriality. This is more curious. What do you mean when you say immateriality? It just means kind of non-material. It's negative. You're removing a material aspect of something. Now, I take it, I personally don't believe in the kind of revolutionary interpretation of science. I more go along with people like Father Wallace, or well, even Lennox, or Weisheitel, right, who think that the progress in science is more in detail. So I think basically Aristotle's description of basic principles is more or less correct. And Thomas's arguments here often rely on them. We don't have time to study for them or argue with them at length. But in general, things that are bodies or material, they have dimensions, they're capable of becoming other things, right? So you can run over a dog or a cat, and you can eat it, right? Well, we wouldn't do that with dogs and cats, but I know people who do that with moose, or deer, armadillos, right? You don't believe me. In Texas, somebody was telling me about how in the ranch, people would go out early in the morning and get a spray paint all the dead armadillos on the road near their ranch. Then in the next morning, you find the closest one that's not spray painted, and you know that one's fresh, make some tacos, right? It's a material thing. I mean, it's no longer an armadillo when it's in you, right? But there's something about that armadillo that's capable of becoming you, right? Not the case in something immaterial. If you talk about the human soul, what we mean by this human soul being immaterial, you know, somebody can't eat it or suck it out of your body or breathe it out like a cat. Did anybody ever see? This is an old movie, Bubba Hotep, where there's a mummy that fell off a truck in Texas, and he sucks out of nursing homes. People don't notice, and they die. This life force kind of out because it eats the life force. And somehow Elvis and JFK are members of this nursing home. JFK is played by Ossie Davis. The idea is that they made him black so that he wouldn't be assassinated. And they managed to defeat the monster in the end. But that's this idea that you're sucking the soul stuff, right? That's not what we mean when we say immaterial. Okay. If something can suck it or eat it, or change it into something else, then it's not immaterial in the sense of an immaterial substance. So that's just some kind of description of what we're talking about. Now, when we get to knowledge, when we talk about immateriality, that's the tricky thing. We're just removing some notion of bodily presence. So in general, when Thomas Aquinas thinks about knowledge, he's thinking about an interaction between the knowing subject and the external world, right? So you might have an armadillo, you might see it and look at it, you might eat it. What happens when you eat the armadillo? It becomes part of you, there's a physical presence in you. When you see the armadillo, when you smell the beautiful armadillo odor, when you hear it skittering about, right? In some way, there's something, some connection between you and the armadillo that wasn't there before, right? But it's not physically in you, right? The smell of it, is, or the color of it, the picture of it, doesn't. It's not in you in that way. Right, you can't like cut into somebody's brain and take a look at and see, oh, there's the picture of the armadillo. There's the little man looking at the picture, and there's the picture. Sometimes people think of the soul this way. I don't know. When I was a kid, they may still do this. They used to teach us that the eyes would turn the images upside down, and then our brain had to move the image back around. Like I guess the idea was the little man in there can't quite see it if you don't turn it back up. I mean, who's looking at it, right, from behind there? I don't know. But no, I can remember them teaching us this, you know, and I just thinking, yeah, so the brain then turns it around because the little man in there otherwise would see everything upside down. It's kind of crazy, right? Because it's not in there, that picture, right? But there's some sort of presence in there, right? And when you think about it, there's some sort of presence even in the medium. Like I'm looking at all of you. I can see different shapes, different shades on the clothes. There's different locations, right? There's somehow what you are, what you're doing, the moving of your arm is in some way present even between you and me, or I wouldn't be able to see it. So Thomas Aquinas would call this immaterial, right? Now, the sense knowledge is immaterial, but here we're just removing the bodily presence from something. It doesn't mean that there's some sort of immaterial substance or immaterial knowing power. It just means that the actuality, what's in the object that you're sensing, is present in the one knowing in a different way. You've got the actuality that's out there somehow present in my organs and in my brain, but you aren't, right? And it's not like I'm eating you, right? Not that kind of presence, but there's some sort of, it's called an intentional presence. And so the senses involve this reception of an actuality from the thing known, the way the thing is, into the body. All right. Now there are all sorts of different levels when we think about different kinds of sense knowledge. Aristotle defines animals as things that have sensation. You might think, what about a clam or oyster? I don't know, do people clam in Connecticut? Where I grew up, you've got clamming and you bend over and you rake up them up, and how do you find where the clams are? They move around a little bit, right? They've got little squirting and things, and you can see the little holes. And they react to their environment, and they actually do move around a little bit. That's how you see the holes in the, at low tide on the top of the thing. You know where to put your rake in. But the Thomas and Aristotle would think there's not a lot of mental activity going on there, right? Right. There's something. But basically, as animals become more developed or perfect, in the sense that they're having more being, more things they can do, they have more exterior senses and more interior senses. Right? So maybe the oyster just has some sense of movement or something, right? Touch in some way. Thomas actually thinks that touch is more than one sense. It's a collection of different ways of getting information about the environment. So it's a kind of more of a genus, but with one organ. Whether that's true or not is another issue. But then you have hearing, sight, smell, all of these other exterior organs, ways of experiencing the world in different ways. And then when you have brains and central nervous systems, you can kind of retain that information, right? You have to develop notions of this kind of animal is dangerous, this kind of animal isn't dangerous. You can react, that looks like a big group, or that animal's bigger than me, this animal is smaller. Right. This is still having the presence of an actuality in you, but it becomes more and more open to different parts of the world, the more developed the exterior senses are, and the more developed the brain is, right? Things can know what's happening, remember what's happening in another room. Your dog can kind of know, you know, well, this is where my dish is, right? Now, none of this, all of this is immaterial in the sense that the world is present in the animal and the animal is conscious. But it's not immaterial in the sense that we have to think that there's some sort of, you know, indestructible soul in the animal. It's just a fact about things that have sense organs and that have nervous systems. So when you think about what it is, you have then this quote one, a sense is what has the power of receiving into itself the sensible forms of things without the matter. It's a kind of immateriality, but it's a kind of immateriality that has nothing to do with immaterial beings. But it's important to grasp that this is what sensation is about. When we talk about what is sensation really. Now, Democritus, for instance, wanted to talk about sensation as little atoms coming in and moving around, and that's the physical presence in you. You aren't eating it, but somehow those atoms are present in you, but you still have the problem of, is that going to be digestion? What's sensing? How does this work? All right. And so when we think then about consciousness here, you have something that's the act of a physical body. But it's not completely reducible to what we would describe as, say, physics or biochemistry, which doesn't mean that there's something spooky going on just because it's not reducible. But for example, think about what your dog is doing, right? Your dog sees the food. He walks towards the food. The dog wants the food. There's some sort of unit there that we attribute walking to, seeking, right, eating. We talk about his experience of the food. Oh, you enjoyed that, didn't you? Right. And if you think about the neurologist and the dog psychologist, they might give different descriptions of what's going on. I mean, you can give a description of what's going on at the level of the chemistry, or at the level of physics, right? Some people think that you could just reduce everything to physics. I've known people who think that, right? Chemistry and biology and evolution, this is just shorthand for what we know through physics, right? Particles and how we would do it. It's like the real world's too complicated, so we have to dumb it down a bit. But at any rate, I don't think that's true, but it's a belief that some people have, but it's important that the process of perception is different from the biochemical process. And one thing that Aristotle distinguished, a distinction that he made that was amplified in the tradition, is between immanent acts and transitive acts. Transitive acts are when one thing acts in another, or things move in a place. Those kind of are measured through time, the actualization of something, potential, qua potential. This could be over there. It's on its way to being over there. Now it's over there, right? My finger's moving. Whereas an immanent action is kind of complete on its own. It has a kind of presence. Like when we see things over time. I can see you moving, but my act of seeing, it's an experience that is complete in itself, all at once. It somehow has a presence in time in a different way. Now, with our physical images, you can map one on to another. I mean, Peter Geech, when he's talking about the difference between the psychological and the physical changes, he notes that Norman Malcolm was right when he said at a meeting in Oxford that a mental image could be before one mind's eye for just as long as a beetle took to crawl across a table, right? You could measure it. I hope they would clock to the same thing, right? Like if you measured the brain waves and the person had the experience of seeing the beetle, the more or less stopped, it started and stopped at the same time. It would be strange if it didn't. I assume that it does. How exactly you'd measure that, I'm not sure, because of the feedback and the time. But presumably, I think, we would assume that they would start and stop at the same time, even though they're different things. There's a kind of stream of consciousness. Now, in the sensation, it's always with material changes, and it's always an act of something material. I don't know how to describe this in contemporary philosophy of mind. Part of it is if you have a kind of reduced notion of matter, you have a very hard time explaining this. If you want to read an interesting book, one by Madden called Minds and Matter, something like that, James Madden at Benedictine has a a book about this, trying to relate it to contemporary philosophy of mind. But the sensory knowledge, it's an act of a bodily organ, or the sensory desire, right? Might be a group of organs working together, might be part of an organ, but it's an act of a bodily organ. So that's sensation. Whether it's internal, like in the brain, or if it involves external organs. Okay. Now what then, if we talk about the immateriality of the human mind? That's a little bit trickier. Now generally, immateriality was something that the better ancient medieval philosophers thought that you could just show, and you had to have in order to explain intellectual knowledge. Right? Aristotelians, Platonists agree about this, Arabic philosophers. The immortality of the soul, that's something harder, right? But immateriality was a lot easier. Why? Well, if you look at the basic argument, if you look under intellectual knowledge, say this quote number 3, this is from Aristotle's De Anima. Since everything is a possible object of thought, to know must be pure from all admixture. For the co-presence of what is alien to its nature is a hindrance and a block. It follows that it can have no nature of its own, other than of having a certain capacity. Well, what does that mean? Why would Aristotle say that? Well, if you think about what's going on with sensation in the organs, each organ is adapted of our external organs, our sense organs, to experience a certain kind of thing, right? To receive certain kinds of forms, kind of information from the world. In fact, Aristotle notes, if it's too extreme, you destroy the organ, right? What happens if something's too bright? You can go blind, right? I know that it's approved to go to Medjugorje now, but some years ago, there were cases of where people would go to Medjugorje and look at the sun and go blind. There's an important lesson there. Don't look at the sun with your naked eye, okay? Bad idea. Why? It hurts it, right? You can feel different temperatures, right? So what happens if you put your hand on a fire or on a stove that's too hot? Well, right, that kind of, you don't really feel those high extremes. So the organs interact with certain kinds of information and kinds of things in the world. Like sight involves light and color, touch, heat and cold, rough, smooth and rough, those kinds of things. Smells, certain kinds of whatever. I don't know, like taste. It's sort of related to touch somehow more closely. Right, hearing, sound. Oh, luckily, you guys, the young people now seem to all listen to rap and rhythm and blues, right? If you were my age and listening to people like Ozzy Osbourne, what would happen to your ears? You'd be deaf when you're 55, okay? Right? Because people would listen to rock music so loud that it would blow out their ears, right? Or also, I don't know about Connecticut, it's rural New England, part of it, I guess, maybe, but it's still not like Maine. But if you like to go in the woods and like shoot old beer cans and things, right? If they do that here, right? In the old days, people didn't wear protection on their ears. All the time you're shooting guns and it has an effect, right? Also just within the range, like too bright, not bright enough, too loud, not loud enough. So all the organs have a kind of range, right? And so they're limited. The object can destroy it if it's too powerful. Also, there's a range within it, right? Like some animals can see things that we can't, right? Not because they're seeing ghosts, but because their eye is better adapted than ours, right? Or hearing. Some animals can hear things that we can't. Or you probably can hear things that I can't. Like when you're older, your ability to hear certain high-pitched noises goes down. It's because the organs are designed for a certain kind of information. Now, when you think about the mind can think about pretty well anything. It doesn't have these limits. It's not concerned. It takes everything from sensation. It uses senses to think, but it's not limited the way an organ is. And you might say, well, a dog takes sensory information and does stuff to do it, moves it around and adds to it. So what's the difference? Well, if you think about a dog, we have a math major here. Animals have some notion of certain quantitative differences, right? This animal's bigger, this animal's smaller. Run away, run away. Okay? That's a kind of... But in terms of thinking about what's the measurement of this animal, how much bigger is it than other animals, what is the range that's dangerous, you're starting to think about more general kinds of things. You know, what would anything that's measurable be like? What is length? Right? So you're capable of comparing, doing things at an abstract level, which other animals don't seem to have been able to do, right? They have animals that can kind of count, although sometimes, John Skelka has an interesting essay on this. A lot of times they kind of trick it, like you think the horse is counting, but really the person's moving their head. I mean, the person's not tricking people, the guy is the friend of the horse or owns the horse because he doesn't know he's doing this, but the horse still picks up on it. But certainly, I mean, like the Pythagorean theorem, that would be very strange if a horse or octopus could do it, right? You see how there's a kind of abstraction and ability to think about different kinds of things, like your dog, right? He goes towards the food. And I say, aha, I tricked him. He thought that was a cow meat, but it was really, right? I didn't want to, you know, I mean, it looked like they have... like signs and security. I went over to look at your cows today. And so suppose I'd been using cows to feed my dog. And then I realized, oh, I'll get caught. So I found a way to manufacture cows, right? I gave cow meat. I gave him like soy meat. Oh, I tricked my dog, right? My dog thought that he was getting a cow, but it was a whole different kind of thing. It was soy. Does my dog care or really have a notion of what the meat is or what a cow is or something like that? No, right? He doesn't really have this notion of kinds. Now, dogs can react to kinds of things, right? Your dog will react differently to a cat, to a squirrel, to a different dog. So, like your dog can react to bigger and smaller. It can react to bigger and smaller without having really developed mathematical objects of knowledge. Similarly, it can react to different kinds of things without having any notion or definition of what things are, okay? So that's what's distinctive then about the intellect, is it seems to have an operation that can't really be an act of the body, the way that our exterior and interior senses are acts of our sense organs and our brains, you know? I mean, I think we assign them different places. I don't know if you've seen these medieval maps of the brain, but they think everything like our imagination and our sense judgments and things are in one part of the brain. I think now we spread it out a bit and there's stuff inside and outside. But this is exactly where I think scientific knowledge grows. If you read medieval or ancient philosophy, the real particular stuff that's hard to know, that you need experiments, you need lots of people cooperating. I mean, just the number of people doing things now, the amount of stuff that we can know and learn about, I mean, it's just amazing, right? And that's something that you can't look to Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas to. But the more general things, often I think they're better guides. But that's because it's easier and it takes fewer people. And in some ways it's easier. You might think, oh, it's so hard to read Aristotle's De Anima. Yes, it can. There's disagreements. It's better if you read it with good commentaries like St. Thomas's, but compare it to what people know about the sensation of animals now. I mean, there's no way one person during their life could figure all this stuff out. It's just We just know a lot more about particular things, right? So we know then that the brain can do a lot, but it doesn't seem like it can be able to have this kind of knowledge. Of knowledge of all objects and universal objects. In his early sentences, Thomas gives three arguments that against the ancient pre-Socratics who thought that the intellect was an act of the bodily organ the way that the senses were. This is in text number 4. This operation has all bodily forms as objects. That's the first one. That's right from Aristotle, right? Yet it's not limited to one kind of source like the senses are. Second, that it can be of universals, whereas bodily organs aren't about universals, right? They can group things together, your brain can. But that's not the same as knowing the definition of a thing. And then third, this is interesting, the way that the intellect understands itself. Thomas rarely uses that argument. It's hard to know what he means, except that a sense like your eye doesn't see your eye, right? That your intellect can reflect. First, we know external bodies, but then we can reflect about them and in some way know the self. It's hard, but it's distinct from what a sense organ can do, according to Thomas in this early text. Most often, he just goes with Aristotle's argument, this ability to know all natures of physical bodies and not to be limited from one source. Not straight from Aristotle. The argument about universals is related to it because Aristotle said, what's our intellect about? The natures of material beings. So not just the individual thing, but the nature. The third point about, he calls that a sign, like not really like an indication in some of his later texts. It's a sign that the operation is not bodily. And that third one kind of drops out. Now, one objection that people might have is it seems like it requires an organ, right? Because what happens if I'm playing hockey and I fall and hit my head on the ice? Well, if I don't hit it very hard, that's a problem. But it's not really going to affect me. But, oh, you're all younger than me. So, right, in Texas, people don't know about playing hockey on ponds. I grew up in Maine, so we played in ponds in the winter, like you may do here. I don't know if the ponds freeze. But back when I was a kid, nobody cared about head injuries, right? Nobody bothered wearing helmets. Nobody really paid attention to what kids did anyway. It was like being a wild animal. And so it was pretty common to hit your head really hard, like on the ice. And sometimes your thinking gets sort of messed up for a little bit, right? You get hit in the head pretty hard. Now, if you hit hard enough, you can't think at all, right? Also, in the Middle Ages or late ancient times, people had pretty good head wounds that you could study. And so that's one reason why they thought these things were in different parts of the brain. Like, right, sort of give somebody a wound here, then this thing happens. They wouldn't give somebody a wound. They were very against experimenting on human beings, actually. But luckily, there were lots of wounds. Okay. So, you know. But it is kind of a block to science, right? If you can't just experiment on people or corpses. Yeah. Okay. No, I'm kidding. I don't think we should experiment on people in any way that we want, okay? In just any way we want. But at any rate, right? Well, Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle think that we always need our body to think. At least in this life, Thomas Aquinas says. Why? We get all of our information from the bodily senses. Also, if we're just talking about things like we're doing now, what am I doing? Speaking, right? You can write the words down. The words have a certain sound. You can remember the words. Maybe you can't, but if you were to remember it, you might remember the words. all of these are bodily, right? We think about one thing rather than another. Often we have images, symbols. In some way, we rely on this sense information. And it's very easy for things to go wrong, right? A lot of times, what happens in mental illness or a mental problem, right? Something goes haywire with the few chemicals here and there, or, right? Or if somebody gets a brain cancer, a brain tumor, the personality, they become violent, difficult, that happens, it's horrible. Right? In order to function well, we need to have our brains. Now, that doesn't mean that the brains are sufficient for our thinking or that our intellectual thinking is an act of the brain, right? There's a difference. That's why Thomas compares it to sight, like in Aristotle, that's in text 2. The sense information is to our brains like the colored object is to sight. We can't see without there being light and colored objects, right? Turn the lights off, we'd still have light coming in outside. But absolute dark, we couldn't see, or without any sort of color. Every time we see, there's colored objects, but that doesn't mean that the seeing is an act of the object, it's an act of the eye. Similarly, Thomas thinks with the brain. There's always going to be brain activity. And if you think about the inner senses and their relationship to our intellectual thoughts, Peter Geach brings this out. Take a statement like, all tigers are dangerous, right? That's a transitive act. You could study the wavelengths, you know, you could write it on the page and it would occupy a certain space on the page. All of those things are material. The thought is something very discrete, happens at once, right? Doesn't happen when you say all, doesn't happen when you say tigers, doesn't happen when you say are, or even dangerous. It's a discrete thought, but we only express it or think it in terms of these bodily or physical changes, even if they're just in our brains. We often move from one thing to another in this. The thoughts themselves are discrete, right? Or 3 + 5 = 8. It's not like I've got a 3 + a 5 and then an 8. I do, maybe in my mind or on a piece of paper. That's not what it means, right? And so in this life, we don't know what it would be like to think without a brain. Be very strange, certainly unlike anything that we do. But that doesn't mean that our intellectual thinking is an act of the brain. It's a different point. So all of this is to argue that there's an act of the intellect that the body doesn't share in. And this gives us reasons for thinking that the soul is immaterial. To give a full account of Thomas's argument, you need to talk about form, matter, subsistence, and substance. And I think Thomas thinks you've got a demonstration there, although some people have disagreed. That's one thing, that reason why there was a big, like Vatican II is a reform council. There was a big reform council right before the Protestant Reformation, about 1512 or something. Lateran V, it was mostly concerned with Aristotelians who thought that, you know, you couldn't prove providence and the immortality of the soul and things like that. And it didn't say you could prove it by philosophy, but it said philosophers should try to show that the soul is immortal. Right. Not a dogmatic definition, but a recommendation of what philosophers should do. They kind of missed the big changes and the problems that would exist in the 16th century, but, right, I mean, the Holy Spirit preserves these things from dogmatic error. It doesn't mean that the people are going to be able to read everything correctly or know what's going on. But I think, nevertheless, it's a nice guy. Right? Descartes was influenced by it. He cites it in the prologue, or the letter about his meditations, I think. He mentions, right, because this is what the council asked us to do. At any rate, So the idea is, if something has an operation of its own, right, in some sense it's a thing, it exists, right? Like our eye can see, right? Our hand can hold a cup of coffee. Now, what happens, though? How do you get rid of things? Like, well, the form or the way that things are, the forms usually disappear with the matter. So I run over a squirrel. Squirrel soul is gone. Squirrel's gone. The squirrel soul is just the activity that makes it a squirrel. It's all gone, right? No longer a squirrel. Because a squirrel doesn't have any kind of activity of its own, but the soul does. And so when you think about the soul as a subsistent form having an operation of its own, it's not like bodily parts, right, that somehow depend on something else for its existence. The soul has an operation and existence of its own. So there's going to be no way to explain how that, at least, comes apart. I think it's very weird for humans to die, at least from the perspective of the soul, because we're physical beings, right? We're not angels, so it's very strange. It's hard to know what it would be like, but he thinks that, you can argue from the subsistence of the soul to its immortality. Another kind of argument he gives is a sign. A sign means kind of a dialectical argument. Thomas's texts are full of this. People often read syllogisms and think, oh, he's just proven something or demonstrated it. Well, a demonstration in the strict sense requires premises that are first and prior and necessary, and you really see how the conclusion follows from them. So one person might read a syllogism and it's demonstrative, and another person reads it and it's not, because they don't understand the premises. Moreover, sometimes you might have a syllogism with things that are mostly true, but we don't quite know how they apply. And the nature does nothing in vain arguments are often of this sort. So if you look here, under immortality, text 2, I gave you text 1, this notion of subsistence. 2 is the idea that the senses all perceive individual things existing here or now. But with the intellect, we're open to being that is not restricted to any particular time or place. And so then there's a kind of desire for a kind of going on forever, or eternity. And this is a sign, then, that the soul is a material being. You can put that argument in syllogistic form, but he says it's a sign because that argument doesn't have the certitude. We don't know exactly what it means to say that nature does nothing in vain. We don't know, right? It's not. Still, you can have a good reason for thinking it based on this kind of argument. But it's different to have a justified belief and to actually really know something. And in general, people find it very hard to prove the immortality of the soul. Duns Scotus thought you can just give good arguments for it, and he's even ambiguous about whether Aristotle believed in individual mortality. Right? And he's a blessed John Duns Scotus. So that's how you approach immateriality and immortality. Immateriality through knowledge, the reception of form, something distinct about the intellectual materiality. And then from there you go to the being of the soul and how it's different from other kinds of being. So to kind of sum up, when we're thinking then about the immateriality of the soul and immortality of the soul, it's important to recognize that we aren't talking about just any immateriality or any kind of activity that can't be described by, say, the techniques of some kinds of science, right? Contemporary philosophy is often concerned with the problem of consciousness. I think there are historical reasons for that. I don't think it's a very valuable or fruitful form of inquiry, but the people have written interesting things about it. More interesting than this consciousness is the problem of intellectual knowledge. And that gets you the relevant kind of immateriality. Once you have the relevant kind of immateriality, that gives you an opening to immortality. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.